This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening as we search for a way for the United States to have influence in the rapidly deteriorating situation in Egypt. Also, we'll talk about the Guns of August. A gun bust in New York City shows how firearms can easily make it past the bans of Gotham. Texas lawmakers happy not to be pushed around by the Justice Department regarding their voting maps and voter IDs. Once rejected, now that the Supreme Court has lifted the preclearance rule, Texas wants things its own way as we continue our voting rights tour of the USA. The fast food taco takeover takeaway, more about that a little later. And what if all media networks came with a party affiliation? Would it help or hurt American politics? We'll explore what apparently is a dream of the GOP. But first, the storm of competing ideologies, the availability of weapons, the enthusiasm of regional mercenaries eager to get into a fight that is not their own, are all complicating efforts to try and influence Egypt's chaos amidst Syria's own chaos and a fragile stability, which may be overstating the case, over in Iraq. Governments facing insurgencies all around the region. And today, Egyptian security forces arrested yet another leader in the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohammed Badi. Now the three top Brotherhood leaders are in Egyptian custody, and the violence continues. Joining us is Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Robin, welcome back to the program.
Nice to be with you, John.
What I'd like to do is explore the what appears to me to be a crazy quilt of allegiances and support networks for Egypt and Syria, some of which are outright contradictory in the sense that one agent seems to be supporting, the same groups but on different sides. Let's start with the Gulf nations and get an idea of how Saudi Arabia, for instance, differs from the Qataris.
Well, the crisis in Egypt has divided the entire Arab world, and it's divided particularly the rich Gulf countries. You have Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, which are all standing alongside the military, and they have jointly pledged $12 billion of aid in a pointed attempt to compensate for any loss from aid provided by the West, the United States and Europe particularly. Each country has slightly different issues, but Saudi Arabia obviously is the most powerful speaker in this troika, and it has concerns at multiple levels. First, it was never crazy about the democratic experiment in Egypt. Saudi Arabia is the most powerful monarchy probably left in the world in terms of absolute rule. It also never liked the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood took Islam and entered modern democratic politics, and that was something that was crossing the political threshold for the Saudis. And it has been outspoken in the last 3 days in challenging the West and even implying that the West was rather ignorant in understanding what was happening in Egypt and things were now being corrected.
Now, in the case of Qatar and Turkey, they're attempting to be regional interlocutors here, intermediaries, attempting to steer some sort of middle course. How's that working?
Well, Turkey's particularly interesting because it has long been a model for many of the political Islamist parties that have arisen in the Arab world over the last 2.5 years. Turkey is a very modern state, a member of NATO, but has been led for more than a decade now by an Islamist party under Prime Minister Erdogan. And Prime Minister Erdogan has been outspoken in condemning the military intervention in Egypt, as has Qatar, which is a tiny state, a little thumbprint off Saudi Arabia, but one of the most powerful countries in the world because of its extraordinary oil and gas resources.
If we look at Saudi Arabia closely, we see that they are supporting the military on the Egyptian side in a fight against Islamist forces on the streets of Cairo and elsewhere. Yet over in Syria, it seems that they are supporting Islamist forces that are fighting Bashar al-Assad in Syria for reasons that seem to be mostly related to the fact that Bashar al-Assad is a member of an Alawi Shiite minority that is ruling that country, and the Saudis are Sunni. Is that how you see it?
Well, if you thought the Middle East was confusing before, try it these days. You're absolutely right. This is an array of divisions that I have never witnessed in covering 40 years of the Middle East. And you've correctly identified the fact that the Saudis are not supporting an autocratic rule in Syria. Now, this is a huge division that has to do with sectarian interests as well. And that's where Saudi Arabia, a Sunni, predominantly Sunni country ruled by a Sunni monarchy, wants to see the Sunni majority in Syria do better. And so it has used its money to support the opposition. And that has less to do with political systems than it has to do with sectarian interests.
Would you say that Turkey and Qatar are supporting the Islamist movements in Egypt out of a pure sense of supporting Sharia law, that sort of ideology? Or is it simply more a democratic ideology in the sense that these are the elected groups in Egypt and they want to support them for that reason?
Well, I think the interests are different with every country. But Turkey thought that Egypt was beginning in some ways, not always, but in some ways, to kind of mirror its own experiment, and that transformation that opened up the political space to all parties, and in which a kind of middle of the road Islamist party was offering a viable alternative. Qatar has been trying to be a regional player, and that's why, even though it's a small country, it's played a particularly important role in both Syria and Egypt. So all of these conflicts play out at lots of different levels.
Do you think you'll see it play out as Al Jazeera America launches from Qatar, goes on the air today, and attempts to cover this story without disclosing Qatari interests?
I have no idea what Al Jazeera is planning to do, but it's interesting that the Middle East, you know, once talked about having an Arab nation or an Arab brotherhood, that there was unity among the Arab world. And it is more split than I have seen any time since many of these countries became independent after World War II.
Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What if instead of "give me your tired, you're poor," this was written on the Statue of Liberty? "Give me your AKs, your AR-15s. Just stack those extra clips up in my socks, and I'll take a box of Uzis, Colts, and Glocks." Well, the idea of New York welcoming illegal firearms the way it once welcomed immigrants was a disturbing image presented by city officials yesterday as they announced the discovery of a disturbing cache of weapons smuggled into New York City. A new record, 254 guns, charged 19 alleged smugglers. It's New York's biggest gun bust to date.
Perhaps the two most disturbing aspects of the gun trafficking operation were the simplicity of the business model and the complete indifference of the gun suppliers to the mayhem that their actions would cause here in New York City.
New York's special narcotics prosecutor, Bridget Brennan, there. The accused men hail from New York and North and South Carolina. Mayor Bloomberg has called the Carolinas, along with Virginia, the three leading feeder states of crime guns for the city of New York. How does this work? We turn to Daniel Webster, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Is this a simple case of a demand meeting supply, eager supply in this case, it seems like?
Well, in many ways it is. New York has some of the strongest gun laws in the nation. Therefore, there's scarcity on the streets, and that's a good thing. That scarcity, however, does increase the price substantially. And individuals like the ones who were caught up in this sting profit from it.
How does the gun pipeline work along the East Coast? It's a short drive from Virginia to the outskirts of New York City, if not right into the center of town.
Right. People bring guns in a variety of ways, buses, cars, trains. But typically, they're coming from states with substantially weaker laws and regulations that make it very difficult to hold individuals accountable when they traffic in weapons. And proximity does matter. So that's one reason why, in addition to states with weaker laws like Virginia and South Carolina, Pennsylvania plays an important role in supplying guns to New York and other Northeast cities and states with stronger gun laws.
Listen to what Bridget Brennan is saying, talking about this sort of contradiction between laws in Virginia and the Carolinas and here in New York State.
They cannot hide behind another state's gun laws when they know the firearms they supply are destined to be distributed here.
Is it possible that the legality of a gun purchase in the state of Virginia gets protected on some level? If you know they're going to New York, are you committing a felony? It just happens to be a New York felony in this case.
Yes, you are. You're also subjecting yourself to federal gun charges as well. But I think many people who are involved in trafficking feel that there's relatively little risk. They sort of have to be ensnared in stings of this nature often to be caught. Because if I lived in Virginia and bought some guns at a gun show and I made connections with individuals in New York to sell them on the streets, there would be no way to connect that gun to me. And if they ever did connect that gun to me, no sort of trail of accountability that's in place in states like New York and New Jersey and other states of that nature.
Now, of course, the NRA would say that Michael Bloomberg and city officials have created their own problem. You alluded to it earlier by putting in place these restrictions that allow people to buy low and sell high as long as they drive to New York and sell inside the city where there are these risks, but there are also these rewards.
Well, I don't buy that logic. Again, the reason that there's such a markup and a profit to be made is because there's local scarcity in guns. New York has, as Mayor Bloomberg rightly claims, is the safest large city in the United States. And I think there are probably a number of reasons for that, but very importantly, I think there are fewer guns on the streets.
Commenting on a record gun bust, 254 guns seized, 19 alleged smugglers arrested here in the city of New York. That's Daniel Webster, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. He spoke to us from Bethesda. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Later this hour, an investigation into the taco zeitgeist. Hot dogs, PBJs, hamburgers, all in the dustbin of fast food history, but not tacos.
Cameron David, I'm calling from Livermore, California. Try a peanut butter and cheddar quesadilla. Don't knock it till you try it. Also, you're missing a golden opportunity by not calling this episode of the show the Taco Way. It's a bit cheesy, but hey, it's a meaty opportunity for a tasty bun.
Curtis from Flagstaff, Arizona. Being from southern Arizona, we make our own tacos weekly. Chicken dinner one night, then chicken tacos for a couple nights thereafter. Clean meat sauteed in our dead salsa. Been at it for more than 25 years.
Loving that, Curtis, in Flagstaff. But Cameron David, maybe David Cameron at number 10 Downing eating tacos. That's my taco way, bud. Christian likes the banh mi taco from Gastropod Miami. It's pretty amazing. He writes, tell us your taco story at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us how you fix it. In the 1950s or even the early 60s, if you were growing up and learning your world history, you might have caught this British-produced Pathé newsreel, either in class or at the movies. There were American versions of this gripping story as well, a true story of a Cold War victory in the Middle East, Iran. First authentic riot pictures, the headline blazed.
Further pictures from Tehran show rioters in action as anti-royalist partisans, supporters of the aged Dr. Mossadegh, set about their work of destruction. Target on which much bitter feeling was focused was the statue of the Shah's father. The fall of the statue looks like being a symbol of victory for the supporters of Mossadegh. Royalists, in the most literal sense of the word, were in for a rough time. Victory was short-lived, for by a dramatic turn in events, the royalists staged a coup d'etat under General Zahedi. The people showed their preference in no uncertain manner, and after 9 hours of bloodshed, the forces of the Shah were in command, and Mossadegh's reign as virtual dictator of Iran had ended. Once again, the thoughts of the populace turned towards their sovereign as they waited for his return.
Gripping stuff. The progressive pro-Western Shah of Iran defeats forces of the dictator Mohammad Mossadegh. The Shah, our powerful friend in the Middle East, along with Israel and Saudi Arabia. The problem here is that this newsreel is more fictional than a movie by Ben Affleck. The dramatic turn of events described there was a CIA-engineered coup that took down the elected Mossadegh and restored the unelected Shah. That CIA coup has been well known for decades. It became one of the reasons the U.S. was called the Great Satan by Iranian leaders after the Iranian Revolution brought Ayatollah Khomeini to power. The CIA has never acknowledged its role, though. But recently, declassified CIA documents constitute an official admission that the CIA was behind that 1953 Iranian coup. Malcolm Byrne, director of the National Security Archive at George Washington University, joins us. Malcolm, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
We've known this for a long time, yes, and how have we known it, and what do you think the significance of this admission seems to be?
Well, we've known it from, you know, more or less day one, depending on what sources you want to trust. The very day after the coup, there was a report from Moscow that the U.S. was behind the coup. Now, Moscow, not exactly your most trusted source necessarily, but within a year of the coup, a much better source, if you will, none other than the Saturday Evening Post, the old magazine, ran a story with a lot of detail about the coup that could only have come from CIA sources. So it's been in the public domain for almost 60 years. And over the subsequent years, we had a number of memoirs written by spies who helped organize the thing, tons of articles, interviews by scholars with these guys, and they've been very candid about what they did. So it's a little bit of, you know, taking credit on the one hand by CIA people and denying the whole thing on the other hand.
You heard that newsreel, right?
It was terrific.
I mean,
I don't know where you found it. That was great.
Well, it's on YouTube now. You can find these sorts of things. There's all kinds of versions, American versions, British versions. I mean, millions of Americans heard that story and thought it was absolutely the truth.
Yeah. Well, they had been fed these accounts of Mossadegh. I mean, he was Time magazine's man of the year after nationalizing the oil industry in Iran. But that's not a good thing. You know, Ayatollah Khomeini was man of the year also several decades later. The portrait of Mossadegh in the American media and the Western media was grotesque. I mean, they just, as you could tell from some of the descriptions in that newsreel. And this was something that the CIA carried to extremes inside Iran. Part of their plan to dislodge him was to undermine him politically by planting all kinds of nasty propaganda, saying all kinds of things like, you know, he was against the religion, he was in favor of the communists, he was homosexual, he was Jewish, you know, whatever they could pull together to try to make him look bad. Some of those materials are in this release that are on our website.
And one of the ironies is that the Shah of Iran actually did some of the same nationalization of the oil industry that Mossadegh was accused of doing for being a communist. When it was time for the Shah to go, the opposition to the Shah used many of the same tactics they learned from the CIA in the 50s with their accusations.
Sure. Well, it's tried and true stuff. You know, the CIA didn't invent it. But they sure worked hard at it in this case. And one of the things that's interesting is how many continuities there are in modern Iranian history if you just change the names of the players a little bit. So even if you come to the very modern, you know, present day, you know that the big issue is Iran's alleged attempt to acquire a nuclear bomb and to develop its nuclear program. Well, guess who started it? The Shah.
Mm.
And back then, the U.S. wasn't thrilled about it, but they didn't block it. You know, all kinds of things have happened that one side has taken over from the other side.
Malcolm, I want to play you this clip from President Obama speaking in Cairo in June of 2009. Listen.
In the middle of the Cold War, the United States played a role in the overthrow of a democratically elected Iranian government. Since the Islamic Revolution, Iran has played a role in acts of hostage-taking and violence against U.S. troops and civilians. This history is well known.
But if you had gone to Washington and wanted to know more about the role in the overthrow of a democratically elected Iranian government, you'd have been told, get out of here, that's top secret.
Yeah,
until today.
They would have said, we can't confirm or deny it, which in fact the British have just said again yesterday. There was a British account based on these documents, and they went and they asked for comment from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and the reply was, sorry, we can't say one thing or the other about it. They're still trying to protect their role.
The Cold War takes a long time to thaw, that's for sure. Malcolm Byrne, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Malcolm Byrne is the Deputy Director of the National Security Archive, talking about the final admission in declassified documents that the CIA was behind the 1953 coup that brought down Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. Later this hour, we're talking about the taco takeover. We asked you what kind of tacos you indulge in.
My name is Sarah Bosch. I'm calling from Springfield, Oregon, and I'd like to tell you about my favorite taco topping. It's the Salvadorian kind of coleslaw called cortito, and it's like pickled cabbage and oregano and onions, and it tastes amazing on absolutely everything. The first time I tried it, I worked at a factory with a lot of folks from Latin America, and I had it on this amazing little thing called a pupusa.
Oh, you can get those in Red Hook from the food trucks. Come on over, Sarah. Come on over to Brooklyn. From Fort Wayne, Indiana, I had a taco bar at my wedding reception 2 days ago. A huge hit. Even the stuffy family members enjoyed them. I'm sure they did. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE to weigh in and find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. A once untouchable figure in Pakistani politics, former Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf, has been indicted for the murder of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Bhutto was assassinated in 2007. She served as Pakistan's first female prime minister until 1996. Evidence apparently points to Musharraf from letters written by Bhutto herself. Six other people have also been indicted in connection with the murder. On the line with us now is Akbar Ahmed, chair of Islamic studies at American University and Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom. He's author of the book The Thistle and the Drone. Akbar Ahmed, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what do you think the significance is here of General Musharraf being indicted? I mean, how long has he been under this shadow?
Under the shadow for a long time, but the drama is now coming to some kind of a climax. And it is a drama that fascinates Pakistan. It has a Shakespearean element with three main characters in conflict, the Chief Justice, the Prime Minister, and the former President Musharraf. It has a national dimension reflecting the conflict between the army as an establishment and the civil establishment, judiciary and political setup. For the first time, someone so senior has been actually brought to trial. And then, of course, there's the international dimension with the West, particularly concerned about what would be happening to Musharraf. So great drama in what is happening.
And we're really seeing a power struggle between the very powerful judiciary in Pakistan, the maybe not so powerful, but certainly important civilian government, and, of course, the very powerful and perennially leading the country military.
Exactly. The three points of the triangle of power. This is the power elite of Pakistan. And that is why this particular case becomes of such interest to people. At the same time, remember that Musharraf faces a series of charges. This one, the death penalty for the killing of Benazir Bhutto, is one accusation. There's then the accusation of treason. There are other groups like the TTP and the Baloch who are after his blood. They've given reward money for anyone who can actually kill him. So Musharraf faces a series of very serious challenges in Pakistan.
How much of this is unique to Musharraf? Is it likely he'll be discredited within the army, or will he always be taken back within the army as a revered leader?
That's a very interesting question, and no one can really answer it because the army tends to close ranks. I suspect there'll be some kind of a deal, a face-saving deal for both parties, where Musharraf, like Nawaz Sharif, the present prime minister, was whisked out of Pakistan by the Saudis, and in fact then spent a lot of his time in Saudi Arabia. This may be a deal in the working for Musharraf to get him out and therefore resolve a very difficult situation and indeed a predicament for the government.
Would you say that this process and how it's gone on, really, if we're talking about assassination or conviction for corruption or in this particular case, accusations of murder, is it an indication of just problems within the Pakistani government, or is this the succession process in a sense? Corruption charges, criminal charges, that sort of thing, the judiciary trying to have its way politically?
It's a bit of both, but what is different is that for the first time, the people of Pakistan are actually seeing a former president, a former commander-in-chief, in court and facing charges. This is extraordinary, and for ordinary people, this is hopeful, which means that no one is above the law. And that's why there's so much interest in this particular case.
So if he's exonerated, that will be a destabilizing element on the street?
Yes, in either case. And therefore, I think it will suit everyone if he is simply moved out of Pakistan and perhaps lives in happy retirement playing golf in the UAE or in England.
Akbar Ahmed is chair of Islamic Studies at American University and Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom, author of the book The Thistle and the Drone. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you got your apple pie, meat and potatoes, Jell-O, Kool-Aid, Wonder Bread, Spam, Cheese Whiz, burgers, hot dogs, turkey. All have been candidates to be the American food. But today you may have eaten none of those, but still probably have sampled the 2013 contender, the champion. No more calls. We have a winner. American food.
We're going to have a taco night. Vegan taco night. Are you excited? You
guys? I love tacos.
That's a breakfast taco for you.
Korean taco truck. How's that?
Alyssa is about to have her very first choco taco.
Choco taco.
The taco. Tacos predate the arrival of Europeans in North America. They've gone from Mexican flatbread staple to fold-up fantasy fusion cuisine. Kimchi tacos, waffle tacos, lobster tacos, tacos wearing Doritos or sporting tofu, tacos from roadside food trucks and Taco Bell chains. The Fronteras Desk has put together a five-part series about Taco America. Scratching the surface, folks. That's airing all this week. One person who's part of that series joins us today, in addition to being a lifelong lover and researcher of tacos. David Martin Davies is the news director of Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. David, welcome.
Hey, John. Thanks for being here.
Did you have tacos for breakfast?
I did. My wife makes tacos, and they're delicious.
And you'll have them for lunch.
Probably.
Give us a sense of the landscape there in San Antonio, because some of the greatest taquerias in the United States are located there, as well as restaurants and the range of sampling that you can do right in your hometown.
Tacos from San Antonio are the it's the center of the American taco universe, and it's the bridge to authentic tacos in Mexico.
And describe the underpinnings of that taco sort of universe there in San Antonio. I mean, you've got some of the finest maza there that makes the taco, the flatbread, whether it's wheat or corn, but corn pretty much there in San Antonio, right?
Well, you can get flour or corn. Tacos vary so much. They are beautiful in their simplicity, and they are complex in their variety. They speak to everyone. And as a matter of fact, my theory is that every taco tells a story, and it's telling you something really important about yourself.
All right. So here's this taco. Tell me the story. folded hard corn shell, hamburger in the bottom, lettuce on top, tomato on that. Avocado on that, sour cream on that. What's the story?
Well, the story is that is welcome to Taco Bell. Can I take your order, please? You know, and there's nothing wrong with Taco Bell. I eat a Taco Bell all the time myself, but it's not authentic Mexican food. It is a Mexican food inspired food-like substance.
All right. So I take a taco, soft corn taco, load it with ceviche, put onions on it, and then very, very hot sauce on the top. What's the story there?
Well, you're talking about a Baja California fish taco. That's delicious. And it shows you that in Mexico, the regionalism of tacos is very great. People think of Mexico, who haven't been there, haven't spent a lot of time there, as this monolithic nation. But it is broken down into so many different areas. And you can see that in the food and eat your way across Mexico and just always find something new and delicious.
All right, David, here's a hard one. Okay, can you guess where this listener is from? Fresh garden vegetables, 8 cheese, stuffed grilled hot peppers and peanut oil, fried organic corn tortillas and kid hot sauce along my adult hot sauce. That listener is from
Austin.
Pretty good. Seattle, actually. Not bad.
Okay.
Not bad.
Well, I say Austin because Austin has been trying to steal the moniker as the birthplace of the breakfast taco. And it is that's heresy down here in San Antonio, which, of course, is the actual birthplace of the breakfast taco. But you can't blame Austin. They always, you know, have to work so hard to try and sound cool. But, you know, the authentic birthplace is here because this is where it's a working class food. You know, you get your bacon, eggs, maybe some refried beans, and you go out the door to go to work.
All right, David, I'll let you answer all the emails from Austin. Thanks so much. David Martin Davies is Texas Public Radio's news director and a lifelong lover and researcher of tacos. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your favorite taco recipes. This year's Supreme Court decision, Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder, did not just change things in a county in Alabama. All this week, we're looking at how the voting maps all over America may be changing now that the Voting Rights Act has limited oversight on how states and localities set up their voting operations. In Texas, it's all about maps. One day after the Supreme Court's decision, Governor Perry signed into law new congressional maps, maps that the Department of Justice had already rejected, but which Texas says it can enforce without so-called pre-clearance oversight. The Obama administration has responded by asking a federal court in Texas to restore pre-clearance requirements there, citing the state's recent history with discriminatory voting laws and relying on a very different part of the Voting Rights Act. Kate McGee is a reporter at KUT in Austin. She says that the battle over redistricting in Texas began years before the Supreme Court's decision in June.
It all really started in 2010 with the census data coming out. Texas gained 4 seats in the state legislature with population growth. 89% of the growth in Texas was minority. 66% of that was Hispanic. And so there was this need to redraw the maps in Texas. The legislature met in 2011. They submitted these maps for preclearance, but they were immediately challenged by minority groups and Democrats who didn't think those maps were a fair representation of that growth of minority population in the state. They argued that lawmakers were ignoring the demographic changes. And so they were sent to a panel of judges in San Antonio. They were also sent to a panel of judges in Washington, D.C. A D.C. court found those maps to intentionally discriminate against minorities. And when that happens, it causes a lengthy trial to reach a final decision on the maps, which is still going on. But in the meantime, in 2012, they needed maps for the 2012 general election. So a federal court was ordered to draw interim maps that were used in the 2012 election. And in the most recent legislative session here in Texas, the Texas legislature codified and put those maps into law. And that's kind of where we stood when the Supreme Court came down with this case and effectively neutralized this preclearance requirement.
If the federal government rules that the original maps are incorrect or violate the Voting Rights Act, does that stand? Or because of the Supreme Court decision, is it all completely up in the air?
The attorney general here in the state, Greg Abbott, he says that because the Supreme Court neutralized these preclearance laws, that the lawsuits against redistricting maps should be moot. But on the other side of the argument, where Attorney General Eric Holder comes in, they're saying that you can't ignore these decisions that have been made in the past, that these laws, the redistricting maps and then the voter ID law, which is a whole other issue. You can't ignore that these were found to be discriminatory and that there is this history of discrimination in these redistricting maps. And so that should still stand. And that's kind of where we're going to see this play out in the next couple months as this trial continues coming into the fall.
Well, you know, it's incorrect to call it this, but for the purposes of our listeners, we might as well call it Abbott versus Holder. Let's listen to the Texas Attorney General talking about how, with the Supreme Court decision, he doesn't have to deal with the Justice Department anymore. Listen.
It concerns election maps that now no longer exist. You all have heard about a straw man argument. This is a dead law argument. The maps we currently have in the state of Texas are based upon maps drawn by 3 federal judges, and I believe are free from any kind of discriminatory intent or purpose.
But of course, the attorney general, the federal official here, Eric Holder, says, no, the Supreme Court has not ended the matter here.
Based on the evidence of intentional racial discrimination that was presented just last year in the redistricting case of Texas v. Holder, as well as the history of pervasive voting-related discrimination against racial minorities that the Supreme Court itself has recognized, we believe that the state of Texas should be required to go through a preclearance process whenever it changes its voting laws and practices.
So the feds want Texas to go back to the old days. Mr. Abbott, the attorney general of Texas, believes this is a dead issue. Is there anyone that's going to be able to decide where sort of the reality comes down?
Well, this is going to go to this lawsuit that was filed last month in the San Antonio federal court by the attorney general. They're going to have to make this decision whether or not Texas needs to get this preclearance under another section of the Voting Rights Act, Section 3, which is known as this bail-in provision. Eric Holder is saying that this history of preclearance recently qualifies Texas under this Section 3, that there is this discrimination and that they should be bailed into this preclearance requirement. And in response to that, earlier this month, the state filed a motion to dismiss this whole case, again, repeating that argument that these lawsuits are moot and that there is really no argument. In this brief that the attorney general sent out, he made a lot of procedural arguments, but he made two arguments as well. One that, you know, Texas was put into this preclearance law in the 70s, not when the rest of the Deep South was required for preclearance. So he's arguing a very narrow reading of Section 3, that because Texas wasn't put under preclearance under the 1960s era voter discrimination, that it should be excluded from Section 3. And he's also saying that a lot of these motivations from arguments of redistricting maps in Texas, that a lot of this was motivated by partisan politics. There were not racial means to cause voter discrimination, and that it's more of a partisan issue between Democrats and Republicans. But we've yet to have a response from the courts on that briefing.
Well, in both cases, the implications of the Voting Rights Act decision by the Supreme Court, voter ID, and these maps you're talking about, the spotlight really is on Texas. Here's Joseph Fishkin, professor at the University of Texas School of Law.
This is almost a kind of blue sky situation. We have a very limited precedents that are not even exactly on point. And it's really going to be up to, in the first instance, this court in San Antonio, and then the inevitable appeals up from there, to figure out whether this bail-in provision can be the backbone of a new preclearance regime.
On maps and voter ID, it sounds like Attorney General Greg Abbott wants the preclearance situation to be dead based on the situation in Texas.
Correct. And I think that with this preclearance issue, Congress still has the ability to get together and adopt a new formula for the Voting Rights Act. That's still an option that they could do. But legal experts say that Eric Holder's motion to go the another route and go through the courts to get this preclearance requirement put back in place shows that the Obama administration really doesn't have any confidence in Congress coming together and adopting a new formula for this preclearance aspect of the Voting Rights Act.
Going to the judiciary as a way of getting around Congress. It's an old gambit. We'll see if it works here. Kate McGee is a reporter at KUT Austin. Thanks so much, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
Over the weekend, a cry and a moan from Boston and some Republican Party leaders who wanted to change the channel.
Our party has to quit availing itself to biased moderators and companies that put on television, you know, in this particular case, documentaries and miniseries about a particular candidate that we all know is gearing up to run for president, and that's Hillary Clinton.
That's Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus explaining why the GOP is pulling their partnership with CNN and NBC and not allowing the networks to air any 2016 Republican primary candidate debates. He was explaining it there to CNN's Candy Crowley last week, who might have been arguably the only really effective network moderator in the 2012 debates. But even that is up for debate now. The GOP is up in arms because the entertainment division of NBC and a division of CNN called CNN Films have commissioned separately works that document the career of Hillary Rodham Clinton. The GOP believes the networks cannot be objective, and so they will agree to debate on other network platforms. Reince Priebus is essentially endorsing a position long held by radio host Rush Limbaugh.
For my whole life, what I've been hearing, well, Rush, it is what it is. I mean, guy running for president, if he's going to act like he's afraid of NBC, then how's he going to deal with Al-Qaeda? Or if a guy's going to act like he's afraid of Wolf Blitzer and CNN, how's he going to deal with being president? That's not the question anymore. The question is, why should the Republicans actively participate in something designed to defeat them?
Well, she loves hot political rhetoric as much as anyone I know. With much more on this story, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kathleen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about this idea that if this goes farther than this little dust-up over Hillary Clinton documentaries and films on NBC and CNN, we could be looking at a 2016 situation where networks have party affiliations and air debates or events solely on the basis of their association with a candidacy or a party. Would that be unprecedented? Would that be damaging? Would that be more honest than the way we do things now?
Actually, if you take a look at the questions asked in the debates in the last election, in the primary season, and you just threw them all on the table, regardless of sponsor, and you said, now see if you can sort those questions back by channel, you wouldn't be able to do it. The people who host debates are journalists. They're first-rate journalists, and they don't tend to ask questions biased by party.
So within the news division, there is objectivity, but if there is a sort of full-scale brand look at this, which is what the GOP is trying to do. We don't care if it's your entertainment division, NBC. In corporate terms, NBC supports Hillary Clinton. Therefore, we're going to deny your so-called objective news division any access to our primaries. What do you think of that?
I'd be really surprised if it could actually be enforced. For practical purposes, the candidates are going to go where they can reach the target voter. And to the extent that they're advantaged by going to a venue that reaches a certain kind of voter, that is the natural voter who gravitates toward that channel's other programming, they're likely to go there. So the putative front runner, the likely nominee, is going to want to be starting to look to the general election. He or she is going to be wanting to start to attract independent voters and to speak to those who are leaning toward Democrats but are persuasive. That person is probably more likely to want to be on a channel that is not Fox. On the other hand, while they're trying to mobilize their supporters, because the channel that hosts the debate promotes the debate a lot, it's likely to be attracting those who are consistent with the presumed ideology. That person who's trying to mobilize the constituency and the base is more likely to want to be on a debate in Fox. I don't think they're going to listen to Reince Priebus. I think they're going to listen to the call of the polls.
Do you think Fox is predisposed to the GOP and by implication that MSNBC is predisposed towards the Democrats?
In the non-news programming, you have opinion talk shows on each side that, yes, are predisposed toward the nominee of one party or the other. But when you come into the hard news venues and when you come into the hosting of debates, until you get into the opinion sections, I think you reasonably can say that those are news programs. Those aren't party spokespeople. I, however, would really like to see a debate moderated by Rush Limbaugh. I bet it would attract a very, very large audience of people regardless of party. Not sure it would advantage the candidates, but I think it would draw an audience.
Well, I'm intrigued by your laugh there because we all love entertainment. But again, does entertainment serve the educational value of the electorate? I mean, you can make the argument that the entire primary process, if it had just been canceled, would have probably done Mitt Romney a lot better than the way it turned out.
The advantage to the electorate of having a lot of debates, and I know that candidates don't like a lot of debates, particularly as they move up in the polls and are more likely to be the nominee, but the advantage to the electorate is that the electorate learns gradually across time, particularly where the party as a whole stands. By listening to that range of Republican candidates across that lengthy period of time, or in 2008, both the Democratic and Republican candidates, you were able to get a sense of where the center point within each party was. That's a really important part of learning about what we need to vote. What is the party tending toward? What is it likely to do? Debates are useful because they increase knowledge, but the truth is most people aren't drawn to them because they're going to learn. They're drawn to them because there's going to be an entertainment piece of them, and that's just fine as long as the learning takes place in the process.
Listen to this final comment here from Reince Priebus, the head of the Republican National Committee.
The fact of the matter is, I've got to protect this party and our nominees. We don't want a whole lot of 23 debate rounds like we've had before. And I would just say that entities like NBC and CNN that are moving forward with four-part miniseries about Hillary Clinton are not going to take part in our debates. And look, if you're not going to have 23 debates, these guys are making it a lot easier for us to pare that down to a reasonable number in front of people and entities that actually give a darn about the future of the Republican Party.
You were also waiting to...
What's your response to that? I mean,
he's confusing two issues. You're likely to have 23 debates because the candidates are willing to debate. Anytime the candidate, particularly the front runner, said no more debates, the debates stop. It's not about what the party wants. It's about what the candidate with the power to make the decision wants. Romney ended the debates by simply saying no. He could have done it earlier. He didn't think it was to his strategic advantage. They're going to continue to debate until strategically it's not in their best interest to debate. And they'll find a venue to do it because there will be a potential audience somewhere.
Do audiences want to see miniseries about Hillary Clinton? And does that affect their vote when you're looking at a political debate in a campaign?
There's no evidence that miniseries in the past have affected votes, but you'd have to see the content of the miniseries to know. I can imagine a miniseries that makes it very difficult for Hillary Clinton to become president. I think one should wait and see what the content looks like.
Or wait for the miniseries on Herman Cain. That would have been an interesting one, that's for sure.
Or in the past, you've had important pieces of propaganda for candidates, and I can see as a result a concern. The PT-109, for example, print story helped launch the Kennedy candidacy in 1960.
Kathleen Hall Jamison is director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much, as always.
You're welcome.
All this hour, we've been talking about the great American taco. We want to know, how do you like your tacos?
This is Lindsay Krause. I live in Edina, Minnesota, and we love ground turkey and black beans with fresh garlic and chili powder sauce, diced cucumbers, shredded radishes, fresh tomatoes and lettuce, and salsa and sour cream.
Let's go over to Lindsay's house. Mazuma is from Jamaica and lives in the Bronx. Writes, I would prefer halal tacos. However, I've eaten soft halal tacos. Obviously homemade. I like meat, jalapenos, cheese, lots of onions, little garlic and ginger and cilantro. Up here in North Dakota, one of our listeners named Moira writes, it is popular to make tacos with Native American fry bread. Some people even eat it with bison meat. Samantha from Hollywood, I will sing praises to whoever invented tacos in a Dorito shell. Give us your take. 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, and today, this is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.